This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 5 and 6. Fallen Warrior and... what's the other one? What the hell is the other one called?
Is it the ghoul and the... Yeah.
Or pajamas, whichever one. Which one do you use?
What did you say? The ghoul and what?
Do you say pajamas or pajamas?
Pajamas.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't... There was one... do you remember the Amanda show with Amanda Bynes?
I might be too old for that. No.
It was, you know, it was kind of like one of those, like Kenan and Kel, one of those, like, kind of, you know, sitcom-y or Saturday Night Live for, like, kids, all that. And there was one character who would show up, and he came off as, like, one of those, like, you know, Jersey Shore, like, kind of Italian mafias, and his name was Tony Pajamas, but everyone said, Tony Pajamas, and he's like, pajamas.
Hey, it's a, I took like a regional dialect like thing, a quiz on New York Times, and it was scary accurate. It was very funny. Yeah. I'll have to share it.
Yeah, but the ghoul in pajamas. And in these chapters, we lose Mad-Eye Moody.
We do. R.I.P. I don't know if I expected him to go, but wasn't terribly surprised.
Yep. And then ghoul in pajamas is them doing wedding preparations and in between trying to plot about the Horcruxes.
Yeah, some good old sexist wedding planning there for a little bit, but anyway.
Yeah, we'll talk because I also had similar things to that I made note of. But first, chapter 5, Fallen Warrior, and we start immediately from the end of chapter 4 because, in essence, Harry and Hagrid have crashed onto the ground. And did you, how much did you think that Hagrid was going to die?
I really did not know. And I was very concerned. I'm not going to lie. I thought that this was like, okay, maybe this is the one that I don't know about. And thankfully he was okay. Because I would have not had an easy time processing that, I don't think.
Yep. And so they are not at the Burrow, but they're at one of the many safe houses that have been designated for everyone to, like, land and meet. And so, as we learn, Harry has landed. Well, first he passes out from his injuries because he had some cracked ribs, he lost a tooth, and, like, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And he wakes up lying on a sofa, and he realizes that he is at the house of Tonks' parents, Ted Tonks and Andromeda.
Who looks very much like her sister, Bellatrix.
Her crazy, psychotic sister, Bellatrix. So, right. But at first we start off with Ted Tonks, and Harry is like really confused what's going on. And then even the, you know, Ted Tonks doesn't realize that they got ambushed by Death Eaters.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, and they'll talk about it later, his daughter was involved with this too, so.
Yeah, because Tonks, their daughter, was being the guard for Ron disguised as Harry with the Polyjuice Potion. And she, and they were actually one of the last to show up eventually.
Yeah.
Yep, so yeah, we've got Ted Tonks, and then Hagrid comes back in, and then with Hagrid is Ted Tonks's wife, and Harry's just like, you!
Right, right. And then Ted is like, easy, that is my wife, basically, like, chill. But again, she looks a lot like Bellatrix, but kinder.
Yeah. As she moved forward into the room, Mrs. Tonks's resemblance to her sister Bellatrix became much less pronounced. Her hair was a light, soft brown, and her eyes were wider and kinder. Nevertheless, she looked a little haughty after Harry's exclamation.
You can't blame her for that.
Yeah, so the three sisters. Bellatrix, the oldest, Andromeda is the middle one, and then the youngest is Narcissa, Lucius Malfoy's wife.
Okay. Wow. That's quite a combo, but...
And it's weird because they all have different hair colors. Like, they're the blacks. Only Bellatrix has black hair, Andromeda has brown hair, and then Narcissa has blonde hair.
Yeah, and, like, very blonde hair.
Like, super platinum, like, you know, Targaryen.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, by the way, I was perusing through my Archive of Our Own HB fandom, and there is someone who has done that, you know, Malfoy-Targaryen crossover. I did not read it, but I'm like, yep, I know, I can see it.
Yeah, hair color alone. Makes sense.
Yep. And so they're not intended to stay at the Tonks's for long, because the whole plan is that at each safe house they're gonna get a port key, and the port key is gonna take them directly to the Burrow.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but we've just got to spend a little bit of time here kind of like reassessing and figuring out who's made it and who hasn't. And
because now. And Harry feels so much, like, guilt and upset that he's put, you know, that he has to see these two parents worry about their daughter.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, they're all kind of doing it to protect him.
Yeah. But out of all of them, Tonks is their daughter is one of the most equipped, because she is actually an Auror, like, as a career. This isn't something she's doing in her spare time.
Right. Yeah. She's kind of a little, I don't know. And she's got Lupin. By her side, I don't know,
Well, not in this endeavor.
Not immediately, but like or in his the promise of him. Yeah.
Yes. And then so Hagrid and Harry take their port key and she go and they are transported to the Burrow. And to Mrs. Weasley and Ginny. And they come to realize that they are one of the first to arrive.
Yes.
Because everyone, as we find out in the discussions later had in the chapter, is that everyone is shocked that there were so many Death Eaters there immediately. Like, you know, like the Seven Potters was like supposed to be an extra layer. Like the main layer was supposed to be that they didn't know when he was traveling. And then the extra layer being that there's seven of them, not having to immediately get ambushed and then trying to knock them off one by one.
Right, yeah. So, in that planning, you know, and some to Molly's kind of like nervousness, Ron and Tonks are supposed to be back right away, and they have not showed up yet, too.
Yeah, they haven't showed up. No one else has showed up, and so, yeah, it should have been Dad and Fred. They were wrong. Ron and Tonks should have been first, and then it should have been Dad and Fred. They were supposed to be second. You and Hagrid were third, and. If they made it, George and Lupin ought to be back in about a minute.
Yeah, well, it didn't really work out that way, did it?
No, it did not work out that way, but who is to show up but George and Lupin?
Yeah.
And George is a bit in a bad way.
Yeah, that we have some lovely jokes here in a minute, but I did kind of appreciate how prior to that, or... He's got a scar on the side of his head. I was just going to point out the, I feel like smartly, the only one who checked to make sure Harry was Harry was Lupin, right?
Yeah.
He was like.
Yeah, because Lupin is like, he gives him a security question. Like, what was the creature in my office in third year? And he's like a Grindylow. And... You know, sorry, Harry, I had to check to see if, you know, we might have been an imposter. So why aren't you checking me, panted Hagrid, still struggling to fit through the door.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Lupin is very quick to realize, okay, somehow it got leaked out. How did it get leaked out?
Yeah, he's just, I feel like in that kind of like that scene, you know, Molly is kind of, she didn't kind of test him because I feel like there's an emotional, you know, Molly is kind of, I guess, stereotypical in that. But,
and I guess there's that, also, there's also the sense of, there's also the sense of like, they already are using a portkey from other safe houses to get to the safe house. They would have, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, was the phrase like, you're not being paranoid if people are really out to get you. And I guess this is an instance where there are people really out to get them.
Yeah, yeah. And nothing with a little extra caution can't hurt.
Yep. And so Harry starts to explain that Voldemort came to me, you know, and realized that I was the real Harry. And Lupin's like, why did they, like, how do you recognize you? And Harry's like, I don't know. I saw Stan shun Pike and I tried to disarm him. And Lupin is like shocked. And he's like, Harry, the time for disarming is past. These people are trying to capture and kill you, at least stun if you aren't prepared to kill. And Harry fires back, we were hundreds of feet off. Stan's not himself. And if I had stunned him, he'd fallen. He'd have died the same as if I had used the killing curse. And he also says, Expelliarmus saved me from Voldemort 2 years ago, added Harry defiantly. Lupin was reminding him of the sneering Hufflepuff Zacharias Smith who had jeered at Harry for wanting to teach Dumbledore's army how to disarm. So what do you think about this ethical issue between and the two positions that Harry and Lupin represent?
I feel like it's a little bit of poor planning on everybody else's part because, and I know I said this the last episode, Harry's always going to try to help like the innocent party. So that to me, I don't know if this is, it's, you know, like there was any textual evidence to this, almost felt like a trap, you know, like, you know, I feel like Voldemort and his evilness could kind of think of different things they could do. And it's like, okay, well, if somebody's in danger, Harry's probably going to throw himself on the sword in some capacity, and which is what happened. I also thought it was interesting that he kind of got called out for like, you kind of do this spell over and over again. And it's pretty obvious, you know, that it's kind of your calling card. I thought that was kind of interesting too.
Yeah. So, and Harry is just like, you know, Lupin's like, you cannot let this be a trademark of yours, you know. And Harry's just like, I won't blast people out of my way just because they're there. That's Voldemort's job.
I mean,
because it's all this makes a difference is because they're thousands of feet in the air riding on broomsticks and thestrals and everything else, because you could, he could easily stun someone on the ground if this was a battle on the ground, like he, you know, right. There would be so much more things available to him, but because it's in the air, they have to think of, you know, do I want this person who doesn't have control of himself plummeting to his death?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's, I'm not like pro killing people randomly, so like don't anybody think that. But I also think this is kind of a really difficult situation, and unfortunately you're going to lose some people if this is your methodology.
Yeah. Yep. So Hagrid comes in and yeah, will George be okay? So George has lost an ear and it cannot be grown or sewn back because it's been cursed off.
Dang, like that's something I guess I didn't really put together until this book.
Yep. But and that, then
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh no, it just it makes sense for like an injury. If it's a curse, then you know you can't just go up to the wizard hospital and get it fixed.
So. Yeah. And then the next pair to show up is Kingsley and Hermione on their thestral.
Oh yeah. Badass. Yeah.
Badass thrusters.
Spooky horses. Yeah.
Yeah, spooky horses. And Kingsley immediately makes Lupin answer a security question.
Good.
And then, yeah, Kingsley's just like, followed by five, injured two, might have killed one. And then we saw you know who. Well, he joined the chase halfway through, but vanished pretty quickly. Remus, he can fly. I saw him.
Yeah. I guess that's news to everybody. News to us, like that he can fly. Oh,
yeah, because there's just
powerful.
Yeah, because you can levitate with Wingardium Leviosa, but yeah, like you need a broomstick. Like this is not a normal thing that wizards should be able to do.
Yeah, hopefully we get to find out how he can do that.
Yeah, I just remember listening to Unspoiled and listening to Rashawn say something to the effect of, you know, in the wizarding world, we've all, like, agreed to certain things that wizards don't fly. And Voldemort's just like, fuck that, I'm gonna do it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, because all Voldemort's thing is, I have pushed the bounds of magic farther than they can ever be pushed because I'm such a badass.
He's like
a drama queen.
Yeah, he's like... Elon Musk is trying to do that with things too. So.
Yeah, so clearly there's been a mass breakout of Azkaban, because if they were using Stan Shunt by Guardians of the Imperius curse, because Kingsley was mentioning a few others that should have also been in Azkaban, were in the fray as well.
Right. Yeah. And then go ahead.
No, please.
The kind of person that took the ear off was Snape.
Yes, with Snape's own Sectum Sempra.
Ugh, wow.
Yes, indeed. And it's like, oh, Snape gets his signature, but Harry can't have his signature.
Yeah, Snape. This kind of threw me a little bit, because I'm like, I still haven't figured out Snape, but then he's doing these things. I mean, I know he doesn't really like the Weasleys, but this is... I can't figure this out. I just know that, like, there's something else going on, but he's, I guess, in order to hide and blend in, he's got to Sectum Sempra some people or something.
Collateral damage.
Yeah.
Yep. And then who comes in next is, it's Arthur and Fred, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and, like, for once, Fred is, like, doesn't know what to say. Because, you know, they're always the ones that are on top of everything with the sarcastic comments. And now, for the first time, Fred is, like...
Right, because, like, George is making a joke about it. And he's kind of like, no! I mean, I can only imagine this head wound looks like, you know... I mean, head wounds always are pretty serious, but it looks pretty bad. Which, again, everybody's talking about him bleeding out. I'm like, is this when the one of them goes or not? I don't know.
It's like, how do you feel, Georgie? Whispered Mrs. Weasley. Saint-like. What's wrong with him? Croaked Fred, looking terrified. Is his mind affected? Saint-like, repeated Georgie. You see, I'm holy. Holy, Fred. Get it? And Mrs. Weasley sobbed harder than ever. Color flooded Fred's pale face. Pathetic, he told George. Pathetic. With the whole wide world of ear-related humor before you, you go for holy.
So he's mad at him. It's a bad joke, but he's also concerned. So,
yeah, you'll be able to tell us apart now, anyway, Mom.
It's kind of a little dig at Molly there, like she can't anyway.
Yeah, and then minutes ticking by, and then it's Tonks and Ron showing up.
Thank goodness, because people were worried for a little bit that they would not.
Tonks landed in a long skid that sent earth and pebbles everywhere. Yeah, and Tonks immediately cries, Remus! And, you know, hugs him. His face was set and white. He seemed unable to speak. Ron tripped dazedly towards Harry and Hermione.
Yeah.
And Tonks is like, Ron was great, wonderful, stunned when the Death Eater straight in the head, and when you're aiming at a moving target from a flying broom. You did, said Hermione, gazing up at Ron with her arms still around his neck. Always the tone of surprise, he said a little grumpily.
poor Hermione and Ron, but Hermione seems to, I think Hermione is always surprised that somebody does something like a little better than she does. So.
Yeah. And then who is left is we're still waiting for Bill and Fleur and Mad-Eye and Mundungus. So what kept Tonks and Ron so long is Bellatrix, because as we know, Bellatrix is Tonks's aunt, and it seems Bellatrix was just as much wanting to kill Tonks, you know, for her own family vendetta, as, you know, capture who she perceived to have been Harry Potter.
Yeah, and I mean, part of it, I think, is the humiliation she just had suffered at the hands of Voldemort, you know, him making fun of her for Tonks being married to a werewolf, and, you know, the cubs jokes and all of that stuff. So
and then they each recounted the stories of their own journey, but all the time they continued, absence of Bill, Fleur, Mad-Eye, and Mundunga seemed to lie upon them in a frost, its icy bite harder and harder to ignore. And then what do we got? Then finally, Bill and Fleur show up on their Thestral.
Yeah.
Yes, they deliver the news that Mad-Eye is dead.
R.I.P. I mean, I like Mad-Eye, but, like, this one didn't break my heart as much as, you know, others have.
Yeah, and so it happened after we broke out of the circle. Mad-Eye and Dung were close by. So Mundungus, who is disguised as Harry, panics and just immediately disapparates. And Mad-Eye tried to stop him, but he disapparated. Voldemort's curse hit Mad-Eye full in the face. He fell backward off his broom. There was nothing we could do. And, you know, they're all agreeing that Voldemort did exactly what Mad-Eye thought he would, is that they thought the real Harry Potter would be with one of the toughest, you know, order members, thus being Mad-Eye. So immediately after Mad-Eye, he went for Kingsley, who had Hermione. So yeah, so he was immediately picking off, like, who are the most skilled fighters. Yeah. Only the most skilled fighters would have Harry Potter, which is why, in a way, it was smart to have Harry with, not only not riding a broom, but have Harry with Hagrid.
Would there have been any reason, like, the other people, like, all should have taken the Polyjuice Potion and looked like Mad-Eye or something like that, just to confuse it further?
But as Lupin made mention of, Hagrid would not be able to take it. Like, he's half giant, Polyjuice can only work on full humans.
Could they all take it to look like Hagrid, though? Maybe?
I don't know if it would work. But that's the funny thing, is because Fleur was proposing to be Harry, but Fleur is 25, is a quarter Vila. So she's not fully human either. So, but is it fun? But is being half too much? Like, if you go down to a quarter, is, like, can it work? So yeah, that's kind of interesting to think about as well.
Interesting. I should have saved that for my fan fiction, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Tonks, of course, is really, really upset by Mad-Eye's death, because Mad-Eye was her, like, mentor. Like, she was his protege in the Auror department.
Yeah. Poor Tonks. Man, she's had a rough go these past couple of books.
Mm-hmm. And then, so they give a toast to Mad-Eye's memory. Yeah. And they start to think about, you know, again, how could they have known? Like, who could have betrayed us? And Harry is just like, no. Like, I mean, if somebody made a mistake and let something slip, I know they didn't mean to do it. It's not their fault. We've got to trust each other. I trust all of you. I don't think anyone in this room would ever sell me to Voldemort. And Fred is like, well said. Yeah, ear, said George. With half a glance at Fred, the corners of his mouth twitched. Lupin was wearing an odd expression as he looked at Harry. It was close to pitying. You think I'm a fool, demanded Harry. No, I think you're just like James, said Lupin, who would have regarded it as the height of dishonor to mistrust his friends. Which, kind of a stat, kind of a jab with the whole tail thing.
Yeah. Nope. I don't know.
Lupin's not very lovey-dovey.
No. He's cuts to the chase.
He is not what he used to be. Because he used to be substantially more patient. Even outside of, you know, when he taught Harry. Like, even in books 5 and 6, he was substantially calmer and more patient.
They've all been through a lot. And I guess it's just, you know, how it affects people. So.
Yep. And they think about, they decide, okay, we need to go recover Mad-Eye's body. And Harry's like, I'll go too. And they're like, no, you ain't. You're going to sit right here after all the shit we just went through for you.
Right. Stop trying to be the hero. Just chill.
Yeah. So how do you feel about Harry's, again, his conflict that they're all doing this for him? And, you know, he, again, to me, he is being a little bit of a martyr.
Yeah. So finish your thought. Sorry.
No, that's my thought. Go ahead.
Okay. Are they a little bit doing it for themselves as well? Because does everybody know? I don't think everybody knows about the, you know, like, he has to defeat Voldemort is the understanding. Like,
the precise contents of the prophecy, you know, Dumbledore only revealed to Harry in private, and of course Ron and Hermione directly know. Even if they don't know the full contents of the prophecy, I think all of them are smart enough to realize that Harry is pivotal in this. So so if you look at it that way, it is as much for them and for Wizarding Society as it is for Harry, because they know Harry fits into this puzzle in some capacity, even if they don't know the exact details.
Yeah, I'm so I guess that was would be something that I could, I feel like it could be argued, is that there is a kernel of it, that they're not just all falling all over himself for Harry. It's kind of like, we have to keep this person alive because they can kind of, he can, mm-hmm. I mean,
gonna,
what happens?
He's going to fit into this in some capacity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then everyone's like, where's Hedwig, Harry? We can put her up with Pigwidgeon and give her something to eat. And Harry is just so upset. Poor Hedwig.
Me too. I'm sad.
Yeah, sad. So yeah,
they're trying to comfort him, but with that, but it's not working.
Yeah, because in the movie version, like the way it's shown as giving Harry away, it's shown as you know, Hedwig protecting Harry and getting you know, blocking a killing curse and flying in front of him. Whereas there's no conversation about like the Expelliarmus and the stuff with Lupin.
Okay, so you'll think this is funny. I thought Malfoy killed Hedwig. And for some reason, I think I saw a cut, like somebody, you know, they spliced something and it looked like Malfoy was looking over the stairs and Hedwig was at the bottom. And I was like, so I had been convinced Malfoy had killed.
Like this Hedwig was a movie scene?
Yeah, it was something that I saw somewhere on the internet. So
I think I understand why you would have made that presumption, because yeah, there is something with a dead bird, but it's not about Hedwig.
Okay. So this was kind of I was like, Malfoy's not around. So
yeah, because Malfoy wasn't in this battle. In fact, as we know, Voldemort was using Lucius Malfoy's wand to like try and do away with Mr. Potter.
Whoops.
Yep. And then Harry tries to say, like, my wand did something of its own accord. And they're just like, you know, sometimes you can react instinctually. And Harry's like, bullshit. I did not do crap. It did something on its own. And they don't believe him.
Yeah. I don't know about this. I haven't quite, like, I don't know. Because I think Hermione is the one who is like, it was just instinctual magic, right? And he's kind of like, whatever. It was my... I don't know. That's pretty powerful wizardry, I guess. It's and which would be the fall of Voldemort if he's like flying. Like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Harry crosses into the garden and he gets a vision.
Yeah. Ooh. Speaking of wands, it's not good.
Yeah, because it seems Voldemort has got a hold of Mr. Ollivander.
Poor guy. He's just making wands. Like,
I know. Geez. It's like, Jesus Christ. You told me the problem would be solved by using another wand. No, you lied to Voldemort, Ollivander. I did not. I swear I did not. You sought to help Potter to help him escape me. I swear I did not. I believed a different wand would work. Why, like, explain then what happened. Lucius's wand is destroyed. I cannot understand. The connection exists only between your two wands. Lies.
So, like, I get the impression that, and I've experienced people like this in my life, that Voldemort is probably thinking Ollivander did this intentionally, right? Like, told him, misled him for some reason. I'm guessing that's not the case, but I think Voldemort kind of thinks that.
Yeah, and it kind of shows that even, you know, Harry's thinking about, why did my wand do this? Even Ollivander's like, I don't know why it would do that.
Yeah.
And yeah. He has, like, been doing this shit for, like, 50 plus years.
Right, which I could see, like, where Voldemort would be like, well, okay, he's trying to sabotage me. And Ollivander's like, shit, I don't know. So, yeah, crazy situation.
Yep, and then the vision ends. Harry comes back around. And he's like, tells him what he sees. But it was supposed to have stopped. You're scarred. Wasn't supposed to do this anymore. You mustn't let the connection open up again. Dumbledore wanted you to close your mind. When he did not reply, she gripped his arm. Harry, he's taking over the ministry and the newspapers and half the wizarding world. Don't let him inside your head, too.
Dang. Boom. Mic drop, Hermione.
Mic drop. And that is the end of chapter 5. And we get into chapter 6. The ghoul in pajamas.
Pajamas.
And, you know, everyone's kind of just still in shock over losing Mad-Eye.
Yeah.
And while you can't do anything about finding Horcruxes till you're 17, you've still got the trace on you, and we can plan here as well as anywhere, can we? Or do you reckon you already know where the you-know-whats are? No. I think Hermione's been doing a bit of research. She still said she was saving it for when you got here.
Mm-hmm. Hermione.
These boys would have been dead in book one without her.
She's got some ice cold moves here. Very logic, brain over heart, and we'll talk about.
So they have to stay at least till his birthday, because there's no sense trying anything when he's underage. And then also August 1st, the day after, is Bill and Fleur's wedding.
Cool.
What was that?
Sounds exciting. This wedding sounds kind of horrible. I don't know.
Well, the prepping for it is horrible. Yeah, and Ron is warning Harry, Mom's been trying to get it out of Hermione and me what we're off to do. She'll try you next, so brace yourself.
Good to be warned. And Mrs. Weasley seems like she can be kind of scary and also convincing.
Yeah, and so a few hours later, Mrs. Weasley does ambush Harry in this fashion. May I ask why you're abandoning your education, said Mrs. Weasley. Well, Dumbledore left me stuff to do. Ron and Hermione know about it, and they want to come too. What sort of stuff? I'm sorry I can't. Well, frankly, I think Arthur and I have a right to know, and I'm sure Mr. and Mrs. Granger would agree. It's like, Dumbledore didn't want anyone else to know, Mrs. Weasley. I'm sorry, Ron and Hermione don't have to come. It's their choice. I don't see that you have to go either. You're barely of age, any of you. It's utter nonsense. If Dumbledore needed work doing, he had the whole order at his command. Harry, you must have misunderstood him. Probably he was telling you something he wanted done, and you took it to mean he wanted you. I didn't misunderstand, said Harry flatly. It's got to be me. And it's just interesting that this is kind of a departure, because most of the time people just, what Dumbledore says is law. Rightly, or for better or for worse, what Dumbledore says is law, and that's how a lot of Order members operate, particularly Lupin in the last book. And so it's just interesting to see that not even, and also I think it's a bit, again, this kid is literally of age. It's very demeaning to Harry's intelligence, I think.
Yeah.
Because he should be like, you really think I want to do this crap? No, I don't. I have to.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
To make your life, you know, miserable, or, you know, or tell Ron or Hermione what to do. I get frustrated, and which is why I'm always Team Sirius in that big argument between Sirius and Molly at the beginning of book five, because I'm always in the camp of, you can't save this kid. Trying to save him is just going to put him more in jeopardy and be less prepared and, you know, a lot of things. And so I get frustrated, you know, even after everything, and now that he's literally going to come of age in a few days, and what few protections he had are slowly slipping away one by one, and Mrs. Weasley is still in this mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. She, you would think that she would kind of know Harry. I mean, I know he hasn't spent enough time with the Weasleys, but, you know, you would think she would know. I don't really know if I understand this part where we're talking about the Puddlemer United. What am I supposed to infer there?
Like, Mrs. Weasley's scheme to get Harry alone to ambush him like this is, she was asking him, is this your sock, which has the Puddlemer United Quidditch team. So it was all about a sock and, like, a Quidditch team sock.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm.
And then Mrs. Weasley, like, seems to change gears and's like, okay, well, you'll help us out with the wedding, won't you? And he's like, sure. And she's like, sweet of you. And in essence, Mrs. Weasley's scheming that Ron highly suspects is all the chores that she has the Golden Trio doing, she's keeping them apart deliberately so that they can't plan and that they can't strategize.
Mom manipulation. That's what it is.
Which... Again, I'm not a parent. I can't, you know, I cannot begin to empathize with that just primal need to protect your offspring. But it just is so, you know, exhausting. It's like, you want your kids to survive, you prepare them. It's, yeah. Well, and now yeah. I just went on a whole sidebar tangent in my brain about, you know, again, so many children nowadays, you know, growing up, they're just spoiled and they're not, you know, the whole point of parenthood is to prepare your child to eventually be independent. And I think too many people in this world have children trying to fix something emotional about them. And it's like, bitch, that's not the job of children.
If anything, it's going to exacerbate the problems. It's not going to make them better. So.
Yeah. So. Yep. And Harry has a little interaction with Ginny, and she's basically voicing this. I think mom thinks if she can stop the three of you getting together and planning, she'll be able to delay you leaving. And Harry's like slips up and is like, yeah, like who, like is someone else might kill off Voldemort while she's holding us here making vol-a-vents? And Ginny's just like, so that's what you're doing then, right? And he's like, I'm joking. Like,
pfft. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Yep. Yeah, and all throughout this wedding prep, various order members are coming in and out because Burrow has, in essence, replaced Grimmauld Place as the headquarters for Order of the Phoenix because it wasn't ideal, but, you know, they were able to confirm via Creature that Harry inherited Grimmauld Place when Sirius died. But when Dumbledore died, Dumbledore was the secret keeper of the Fidelius charm, and therefore when he died, anyone who told the Grimmauld Place location to now is a secret keeper, and so the security is just so flimsy now.
Okay, yeah.
So Grimmauld Place is out now.
Well, hopefully we get to come back there at some point.
Yeah. And then they make note of the Daily Prophet hasn't said a word about him dying or about finding the body in regards to Mad-Eye. Harry is also thinking, you know, and they still haven't called a hearing about all the underage magic I use escaping the Death Eaters, you know, because they know I have no choice or because they don't want me to tell the world Voldemort attacked me. The latter, I think. Scrimgeour doesn't want to admit that you know who is as powerful as he is. I've never been any substantial political role with power where perception and facade is so important.
Yeah.
So it's hard. So it's easy. You know, I'm trying to think, it's easy for us to like, you know, look down on Scrimgeour for, you know, caring more about optics and stuff. But yeah, even still, this is getting to a point where, you know, that, yeah, like literally we have crazy ass wizards attacking children and no, we're not going to say anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of what's the motive here behind that silence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see, what do we got now? And then we have another of Mrs. Weasley trying to separate the three of them.
Yeah, all this wedding prep is very convenient.
Yeah, all the wedding prep and separates them, but finally they're able to reconvene in Ron's room.
Yeah.
Yep, and so here we've got a little bit of Ron possibly thinking, not unintelligently, that where's the body? As long as there's a body, they still could be alive.
Right, yeah. Yeah, just like on any show, where's the body? It's not dead until you see the person dead. Sometimes even that's fake.
Even in the Killing Curse mist, Mad-Eye still fell about 1,000 feet. He could have used a shield to arm. Fleur said his wand was blasted out of his hand. Well, all right, if you want him to be dead, said Ron grumpily.
Oh my goodness, the logic, Ron.
Yeah, and then, right, the Death Eaters probably tidied up after themselves, that's why. Like Barty Crouch turned into a bone and buried in Hagrid's front garden.
What?
From the fourth book, remember? The Barty Crouch Sr., when fake Moody killed him.
Oh, okay. Gosh. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And here we get an interesting thing where, again, Harry is flippantly saying, yeah, like Barty Crouch transfigured into a bone in front garden. They'll probably transfigure Moody and stuff him. Don't, squealed Hermione as she burst into tears. And oh no, Hermione wasn't trying to upset, but with great creaking of rusty bedstrings, Ron bounded off and to bed and got there first. One arm around Hermione, he fished in his jean pocket and withdrew a handkerchief and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Basically being the gallant gentleman.
Yeah. This handkerchief is a little not great, right?
Yeah, even though he does clean it with magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, you know, said Ron, giving her a squeeze, you know what he'd say to us if he were here? Constant vigilance, said Hermione, mopping her eyes.
Oh.
And so after this, we've got Hermione. She's basically separating piles of the books that they should take and the books that they shouldn't take.
Yeah. And then this is where we get Hermione spills some tea here.
Spills the tea. Well, at first, Harry is trying to, like, get them to reconsider because, again, he's in his martyr mode.
Martyr mode, yes.
Yeah, he's in martyr mode where he doesn't want anyone to be tainted by his... I think I heard the Katie's knock down something, but...
Oh, no.
That's okay. I think it was just, like, the broom or mop. And Ron is like, yep, told you he'd do this. And Harry's just like, listen. And Hermione's like, no, you listen. We're coming with you. But shut up, Ron advised him.
Good for them. Come on.
Let's see. Yeah. I've been packing for days, so we're ready to leave at a moment's notice, which, for your information, has included doing some pretty difficult magic, not to mention smuggling Mad-Eye Moody's whole stock of Polyjuice Potion right under Molly Weasley's nose.
Yeah.
I've also modified my parents' memories so that they are convinced they're really called Wendell and Monica Wilkins and that their life's ambition is to move to Australia, which they have now done.
Planning it out. Taking care of business. That is Hermione Granger.
Yep. And if I don't make it out, I know that they'll be happy because Monica and Wendell Wilkins don't know that they've got a daughter.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, and Ron got back off the bed, put his arm around her once more, and frowned at Harry as though reproaching him for a lack of tact. Harry could not think of anything to say, not least because it was highly unusual for Ron to be teaching anyone else tact.
Yeah, Ron. He's in love.
Yeah. Hermione, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that Ron and I know perfectly well what might happen if we come with you. So it's not only... Well, it's one thing to be a martyr in regards to the rest of the Order, because they're all adults, but... This is something Harry's been doing since book 5, since Voldemort came back, and like when he didn't want anyone else besides Ron and Hermione to come with him to the ministry. Like, he gets pissed off at the adults not treating him that he can handle all the dark stuff, crazy stuff that's going on. But he also puts himself on this pedestal of, I have, you know, you can't deal with all this stuff, but I can.
Yeah. Yeah, that, yeah, martyr syndrome, and I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people can relate to. Like, not in a wizard capacity, but I'm the only one who can be trusted to do this or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, because they just don't, they don't trust anyone to have the competency to do it.
Right.
Yep, and so, yeah, Hermione has completely, you know, severed connections with her parents, like, magically modifying their memories to get them out of the way, and more or less when they're on the run, she's gonna let people presume that she left the country with them, because that's what a lot of Muggleborns are doing now.
Hmm.
Yep. So. And then Ron, for his part, you know, he can't just make his family completely disappear, but what he's gonna do is he has the ghoul in the attic and has disguised him as a version of Ron with Spattergroit.
Gross, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. So to not raise suspicion, to immediately presume that Ron is with Harry, he's got this ghoul acting as his decoy. So saying that, you know, I won't be able to go to school because I have Spattergroit. And even if people come in, Spattergroit is so contagious and they're not going to want to look too deeply into it.
Well, that was a good move on his part, and great assist by the ghoul, so thanks for that.
Yeah, he's like, I can't communicate with him, he just nods a lot when I tell him the idea.
That's funny.
Yep, and like, and your mom and dad are in on this plan? Dad is. He helped Fred and George transform the ghoul. Mom, well, you've seen when she's... Again, I don't like this dichotomy of, you know, Mrs. Weasley being portrayed as so... irrational and dictated by her sense of motherly affection and maternal protection that she can't be in on the logistics of things just as much as the men around her.
Right. It's also like that boring trope, the TV dad that's like just a dumb dad, and we know Arthur's not dumb, but like the mom that has to be the, like, you know, level-headed, responsible one. Yeah. Yeah. She's no fun. But the dad is like, yeah, you know, he's looks the other way. It's quite the boring trope.
Yep. And then finally, Mrs. Weasley has caught on that they are plotting behind her back, and she storms in.
Right, so they get to do some wedding stuff now.
More wedding stuff, and... But first, it's, Harry talks about he wants to go to Godric's Hollow, which is where his parents' graves are. But it's not just the graves. He also thinks that there could possibly be answers there, because as he gets closer and closer to having to deal with Voldemort directly, he wants to be like, well, what the hell happened there that I magically, you know, super magically, even for the magical world, survived a curse that no one else has survived.
Right, right.
Yep. And then we get a little bit of talking about the dynamics of Horcruxes. What did you think about this little world building of magical artifacts?
I think it was very interesting. I probably was more interested, I don't know why I was focused more on Hermione's acquiring of the information of the Horcruxes.
Yeah, she's so contrite. Like, I didn't steal them.
Right,
They were library books. They just weren't in the library. They were in Dumbledore's office.
I guess, I got pretty hung up on how she could be so, like, forward-thinking that she's, like, you know, after the funeral, like, not very long after, she's like, and then she goes and gets these books. So, yeah, she doesn't steal them. And Dumbledore's dead, right? So, like, what does he care? But very interesting. And gives us some good information about Horcruxes and,
yeah. And you know, what to do. You know, and there are more substantial protective charms so that a summoning charm won't work. You know, Dumbledore left them without a charm just for Hermione to be able to get them, right?
Yeah, yeah, you know, that was the other thing. You know, her Dumbledore is not that. Like, if he really didn't want anybody to get him, it would have been gone. But
yeah, he knew that only Hermione would be smart enough to be like, I only want the person who I want to have them to get them.
Right, yeah, yeah. So, well, good. I'm glad, glad she got them. And,
yeah, it's just interesting her sense of, like, guilt over quote-unquote stealing the books, because that I'm also, as I was telling you off mic, I'm interested in pursuing a hobby of bookbinding. And you know, at least in the beginning, you can make, you know, hardcover books from scratch, but at least in my first few attempts, I want to just take an old used book and, you know, use that to create a new book. But that involves cutting off the text block, and it's like, what do I do with that old text, that old book beforehand? Like, am I desecrating a book? It's going to be a new book. It's going into book related things, but I'm still destroying a book. And so I'm very much in a Hermione mode of wringing my hands on the ethics of this new book binding adventure.
That's okay. It's, I guess just make sure it's really horrible or like shouldn't have been made anyway. I don't know. Yeah, but Horcruxes, we've got a book that has, what does she say, explicit instructions on how to make a Horcrux, Secrets of the Darkest Arts. It's horrible, really awful, full of evil magic. I wonder when Dumbledore removed it from the library. She thinks that might be Voldemort's, like,
and there's key. A lot there. No, it's not directly said how one makes a Horcrux, but it's in a lot of people's headcanon that involves some capacity of cannibalism.
Really? Well, I guess that's pretty messed up.
Because according to She Who Must Not Be Named, like, she had, like, she gave a description of, like, how to make a Horcrux, and her editor looked like she was about to throw up her lunch.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, I guess we won't know specifics, and I guess it's probably not a bad thing. We don't want that out in the world.
Yeah, the biggest thing is that a Horcrux, as Hermione explained, exists the opposite of the typical relationship between a soul and a person's soul and a person's body. Because as she points out, if she were to just run Ron through with a sword, his soul would be totally intact, even though his body was destroyed. That is the nature of a soul being intangible and not susceptible to physical harm. But the Horcrux is the complete and utter inverse of that, where a Horcrux is so dependent on its physical form that once you once you destroy the physical form beyond repair, then the soul, the element of soul dies. Yeah, and it has to, it can't, and it has to be, like, beyond, like, magical repair. It's not just, you can't just, like, destroy it by normal means. There are only certain things that are magically strong enough to destroy a Horcrux. One of them, as we know from Chamber of Secrets, was Basilisk Venom.
Right, right. The Basilisk, and then, let's see, what, stabbing it with a Basilisk Fang? Oh, we're lucky we have such a large supply then. Phoenix Tears, which Fox, he's gone, right? He died?
Yeah, he went beyond, I think.
Okay.
And but yeah. I don't think Fox's tears, like, would fix it. Like, it's, it has to be something magically destructive.
Okay.
So, so yeah, our problem is that there are very few substances as destructive as Basilisk Venom, and they're all dangerous to carry around with you. That's the problem we're going to have to solve, because ripping, smashing, or crushing a Horcrux won't do the trick. You've got to put it beyond magical repair.
Okay. I'm trying to, like, I had my own Game of Thrones crossover moment in my head. I was like, Dragonfire? Would that work? What is it at the, you're more familiar with the Game of Thrones, at, in the basement, or in the green fire. What is that again?
Oh, the wildfire.
Yes. Okay. That's pretty destructive.
Yes, that is. That not also in the same got world. Me. Yeah, no, you just got me going on a tangent in my mind, because apparently I did not know this, but Lacey was telling me, who was on the show for Order of the Phoenix, she was telling me that the wildfire in Game of Thrones actually has a historical basis, because there was a particular type of fuel, a particular type of fire that the Romans or some ancient civilization had that couldn't be immediately doused in by water.
Oh, weird. Interesting.
And people don't know what the hell it was, like, because they guarded it that much, the secret of how to make it.
Cool. Well, we need some of that, maybe, to destroy this Horcrux, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't directly say that Dragonfire would work, but yeah, basically, there are only, from what Hermione's describing, there's only a handful of things that are destructive enough to get rid of a Horcrux.
Oof.
Yep. And then finally we get, after this, we finally have the Delacours arrive. And again, yeah, everyone's been, you know, part of this is Molly's fault, but everyone's kind of really grumbled and frustrated and annoyed that they have to put in all this effort for the Delacours, because they're typical British stereotype perception of the French is that they're stuck up, that nothing's good enough for them, and, you know, all of that. But then we get here, and the Delacours are perfectly delightful people.
Yeah. I bet it has a lot to do with Molly's kind of being self-conscious. You know, she knows they're not the wealthiest family ever, but probably being a little self-conscious too.
Yeah, like, this is definitely all their own, like, you know, insecurities. And again, like, Fleur is not one of my ultimate favorite characters. I know she's a big favorite of Amanda's from Fox and the Fox.
Oh, really?
But again, I do appreciate Fleur's dilemma of just wanting to be a fashionable woman, and people thinking that that's immediately materialistic rather than creative.
Yeah. Yeah. It's creative. Goodness.
Yep. And so, yeah, the Delacours come, and it's her mom and father and little sister Gabrielle. And
who we met.
Mama. Papa. What?
Who we met her way back in the day.
Way back in book 4 when Harry dragged her from the lake. Monsieur Delacour was nowhere near as attractive as his wife. He was a head shorter and extremely plump with a little pointed black beard. However, he looked good-natured, bouncing towards Mrs. Weasley. You have been to much trouble. Fleur tells us you have been working very hard. Yep.
Oh, and yeah. We are most
honored at the approaching union of our two families. Let me present my wife, Apolline. So this is the half Vila, you know.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Apolline. But even like Madame Delacour likes, you know, it seems nice, and she glides forward and stoops to kiss Mrs. Weasley. Enchantée, your husband has been telling us such amusing stories. And Mr. Weasley gave a maniacal laugh. Mrs. Weasley threw him a look, upon which he became immediately silent and assumed an expression appropriate to the sickbed of a close friend.
Oh my.
Yeah, because I guess the presumption is that, you know, if Fleur is able to have a certain level of influence over men being only a quarter, then her mother, Apolline, must have, like, has double what Fleur has.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Wow. Yep. And so the Delacours, it soon transpired, were helpful, pleasant guests, which is, again, why didn't you think you were in the middle? You're stupid.
Right.
Don't be throwing shade at the Delacours just because they're fashionable, man.
Right.
I'm not speaking from all the people I worry might be judging me just because I'm the most well-dressed person at the office.
Yeah, that's nothing wrong with that. Anyway,
so, and then we have, yeah, so they're, like, you know, helping out, and Gabrielle is following around, you know, trying to insist in any way she could and jabbering away in rapid French.
Lovely. I'm sure it's lovely.
Yep. And then there's this interesting thing with Mrs. Weasley. Oh, good. You fed the chickens. We better shut them away. Blah, blah, blah. Very good. Bill's escorting them. You better stay inside when they're here, Harry. I must say, it does complicate organizing a wedding, having all these security spells around the place. Oh, I'm sorry, said Harry humbly. Oh, dear. Don't be silly. I didn't mean well. Your safety is much more important. Actually, I've been wanting to ask you how you wanted to celebrate your birthday. It's like, I don't want to fuss. It's like, oh, well, if you're sure, dear, I'll invite Remus and Tonks, shall I? And how about Hagrid? That'd be great, but please don't go to a load of trouble. Not at all. It's no trouble. She looked at him in a long, searching look, then smiled a little sadly, straightened up, and walked away. Harry watched as she waved her wand near the washing line, and the damp clothes rose into the air to hang themselves. And suddenly he felt a great wave of remorse for the inconvenience and pain he was giving her. Which, I feel like this is being a little manipulative on Mrs. Weasley's part.
Yeah.
I feel, yeah. Again, maybe I'm just assuming the worst, but I feel like her first strategy was quote-unquote neutral just by separating them, and now she's starting to try and pull the heartstrings.
Yeah. It seems, I mean, like, it's annoying, but it is very, I mean, like, I feel like...
Like, they should, at this point, they should just be happy that they're having a wedding at all.
I mean,
because if I were in the middle of a war, I would just be like, okay, we're just going to the courthouse.
Well, I'm like, I'm kind of wondering if this wedding's even going to happen. So, you know, what, I mean, if it does happen, it's going to be the last happy thing that happens. Otherwise, it's just an opportunity for some stuff to go down. That's my prediction.
Oh, you've been reading these books too long.
Yes. I feel like, which, by the way, the front of chapter 7 looks like a romance novel. Goodness.
Yep.
Well.
Yeah, Harry and Ginny.
How romantic.
Yeah, how romantic. Did I tell you that story about, you know, my fairy romance book that I took to the annual meeting, and Lacey was like, I would not be caught dead, you know, reading a romance book in the middle of a conference or in between, you know, our info sessions. And I'm like, I don't give a crap what these people think.
It's more reason. It's more reason to do it. Why not? Just drive people crazy.
Anyway, so thus concludes chapter 6.
Oh, yeah.
The domestic hubbubaloo at the Weasleys.
Not a funny name for a chapter, because the ghoul in pajamas was kind of like not a super heavy part of it. I mean, it was relevant, but
yeah. So, alrighty then. And now we move on to our first exercise, fan fiction time. Or not. It's been a long day.
That's okay.
I had a meeting at 4, and then I had another meeting at 5:30 before this. And working out last minute for my job for a visitor who, even though I told them the budget for their visit and their travel, chose to get a hotel that was $500 a night. So I had to shut that down and do the booking myself, because clearly they couldn't be trusted.
Oh my gosh. Oh, how annoying.
Anyway, so first exercise is Gothic Geek Out.
Are we both going to say the same thing for the Gothic Geek Out?
I don't know. What was yours going to be?
I was kind of the information about how the Horcrux comes to be.
Well, mine was less about how the Horcrux comes to be. It's more just, again, we're going into that territory of, like, the cursed object, you know, housing a lot of symbolism.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, we're, you know, once we get more and more delving into Horcruxes, we'll have to diversify, you know, and our approach to Horcruxes, because again, that is, you know, it's used a lot, you know, as we were talking about, like, there's the very gothic, you know, Slytherin necklace, because jewelry is used a lot, you know, we've got, but we do have other things. We have Hufflepuff's cup, the goblet.
Right. You know, right.
Which, if we want to go deep into Hufflepuff's cup, like that Horcrux, you know, if you want to get into like the Holy Grail illusion, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good point. That's kind of, I don't know. I couldn't, like you said, cursed objects, but just kind of the, I was going to say, I've never really looked into how to curse something. I guess any sort of witch things that I've looked into have been, you know, don't curse stuff because that can come back, whatever.
Yeah. The rule of three, or not the rule of three? It's just the general karma sentiment that whatever you put out, you reap what you sow.
Right. Yeah. But that's, I mean, otherwise, you know, kind of scanning the chapter in my mind, I mean, that's my best go. What about you?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of, you know, what we learned about the Horcruxes, the fact that they have to be destroyed, which is, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of gothic novels where, you know, whether it's like, I don't know why, like in terms of magical objects, I'm thinking of the portrait and picture of Dorian Gray, because in essence, kind of, it is sort of housing the demented, twisted, perverted soul of Dorian Gray while he outwardly is not aging and is doing great and living his life of privileged debauchery.
Right.
It's holding his soul and keeping him immortal, which, so it, in a way, it is very much a Horcrux.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting.
Yeah, but I'm Dorian trying to Gray. Think what else, because, you know, portraits, I think, of course, Mystery of Adolfo, but they don't serve in the, you know, picture of Dorian Gray is much closer. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I'm just trying to think, is there anything in Dracula?
Cursed object in Dracula. I don't think we could qualify his castle as a cursed object. That's like a building. No. So does he? I can't think of anything.
Well, I guess, but... just vampires in general, you have to go through so much trouble. Like, you have to go, you know, run them through the heart with a stake, you have to decapitate them, you have to go through so much extra stuff to make sure that they don't come back to life. So I guess it's kind of compared to a Horcrux, that like you just have to completely obliterate it for it to cease to exist.
Yeah, there are a lot of items that go into eradicating that, so a vampire. I was thinking of a novel, but it is not what I thought it was.
This isn't directly gothic, but more fantasy. Hermione makes the point of saying that a Horcrux, you know, as we saw at the diary, kind of has a life of its own. And if you become like dependent on it, not directly just having the Horcrux, but getting emotionally invested in it, like the way Ginny was taken in by pouring her heart out into the diary. So if you have a Horcrux, it, you know, there's a sense that it could possibly corrupt you. And of course, that makes me think of the Iron Throne, the ring in Lord of the Rings. In essence, the ring, the one ring, is Sauron's Horcrux.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. I'm trying to think of other... I'm looking at my bookshelf and I'm looking at a bunch of books I haven't read. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I've taken a brief break from my nonfiction binge, and I'm just totally doing Harry Potter fandom right now.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's a book from a book called The Discovery of Witches and something. I forgot the number, but that's, I don't know if it's a cursed object. It's just an object of importance. So
I still need to read that series.
I've only read the first one, so eventually I'll get to the other two.
Yep, and then, so, yeah, I think that's a good one to start with, I guess. Because I feel like cursed objects is a piece of, a niche of where gothic literature and fantasy intersect.
Yeah, it is. Gosh, And I'm losing it. Yeah, I can't think of anything else. Other, like, it's a lot of books. When I'm looking at my books, it's usually a lot of like grimoires and curse. There's a cursed book in the Practical Magic series. That's anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And one of the Horcruxes, it's now destroyed. We're not thinking about that one, but one of them was a diary.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I should, for my bookbinding process, I should recreate Tom Riddle's diary.
That would be awesome. People would buy it, and you should make some, and then people would probably buy it. So.
Yeah. Anyway, but first I need to bookbind my Harry Potter fanfics.
I like it. Cool.
So, and now we move on to Tarot of the Day, which I, either the last one or the episode before, I pulled out the Ten of Swords.
The really bad one, right?
A really bad one. And now we move on to the Nine of Swords, also equally bad.
Oh, okay, great.
So, the Nine of Swords suggests that dark thoughts and disturbing feelings are weighing you down and keeping you up at night. You are worrying excessively about a situation, about your and your negative thoughts are getting the better of you, leaving you stressed and anxious. The more you associate with your fears, the more they will rule your life.
I'm a walking Nine of Swords, but anyway. yeah. Interesting.
That, in essence, is Harry's mentality right now. He's in such a war with himself of what he perceives as letting people fall on the sword for him, you know, protecting him, and, you know, and then people, like, he feels emotionally blackmailed when he's trying to remove himself, you know.
Yeah, he's got a lot of, I would argue too that Marley Weasley has a lot of dark thoughts about, you know, his impending doom, and she's trying to, I mean, you can't be as nervous about, if you think everything's going to work out, you're not going to approach somebody that way. You know, I feel like she's very in a dark headspace too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then what else we got? Be careful, because the fear and worry in the Nine of Swords can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. As you obsess over what may go wrong, you are more likely to manifest your worst case scenarios, because you are inadvertently acting in ways that support your negative thoughts. For example, you may worry that your partner will cheat on you even though you found no signs of infidelity. The more you stress about this potential outcome, the more more your anxiety pushes away your partner. And so, yes, the notion of self-fulfilling prophecy. I think Molly Weasley is doing this because, again, she's in that stereotypical maternal protection of protecting, but the best way you protect your children is to prepare them. What, in any magical or mundane part of life, the best protection is preparation, and just so many parents forget that.
Yeah. Yeah, not coddling, but, you know, helping people navigate.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I'm really throwing shade at parents this episode.
That's okay. I've got no problem with that. I'm not a parent. So.
Yeah, no, I'm not a parent either. And again, I'm just thinking of, again, just certain instances with my parents of, again, them thinking the worst possible scenario. And it's like, do you really have, like, thinking the most horrible thing is going to happen? I'm like, did you really think you raised a moron? Like, do you really have that little faith in your parenting skills that you think I'm going to do XYZ and it's going to be a disaster?
Yeah, that's a good thing. I have to bring that up to my parents sometimes.
Yep. The Nine of Swords reminds you that much of the fear and worry you are experiencing is in your head and not necessarily an accurate reflection of what is happening around you. Well, stakes are pretty high right now.
Yeah, the worries are kind of in rooted in some actual problems. So
yeah. Alrighty then. So anything more for the tarot?
You know, I keep thinking, like, I feel like we didn't really talk too much about Mad-Eye Moody's death, and I guess that, I don't know if it's Nine of Swords related, but he did die. We lost a whole character.
And that kind of fuels the thinking, because as hard as it is for our brains to compute, like, every new experience, or every time we have a new experience, like, statistically speaking, it's a blank slate of what could possibly be the outcome. But we are so shaped by our negative experiences in life that we automatically presume and create self-fulfilling prophecies of the bad things always repeating themselves.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that, you know, they think, oh, we lost Mad-Eye Moody. It's the end, you know, that's really bad and more bad things are going to happen, rather than thinking, you know, again, as even as Ron correctly and wisely says, like, he, Mad-Eye Moody would want us to learn from the experience.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just now picked at random the card from the Black Moon Astrology cards, and I got card number 36, which is the 12th house. Subtitle, Escape.
That's a cool card. I don't know anything. I don't know much about the 12th house. 12th house.
I don't know much about any of the houses, which makes me a really bad celestial witch.
No. They're confusing, and it depends on what system you look at, and it's a lot.
Yeah. And so what have we got? It is time to get on point. It's not a time to ignore or overlook what's there. Things may get fragmented. The 12th house of the zodiac is the most mesmerizing of all the houses. Mysticism, dreaming, drowning, vast seas, and surrendering are all the themes that belong to the house of self-undoing. It is also the place in the chart where we lapse in our judgment and make bad choices. Like the sign of Pisces that rules it. I knew, like, all this was like Pisces stuff. And I was like, I'm like, when is the Pisces? I feel vindicated. The 12th house falls at the end of the zodiac, which indicates a type of passage or rebirth. This house contains the meaning of all the signs and planets and all other houses within it. The 12th house stands for the all. Even though astrologers refer to the 12th house as the gutter of or garbage dump of the zodiac, it is still distinct in its meaning. Evolved souls and the doomed live here. Within the 12th house are the highest of the high and the lowest of the lows, ruled by Neptune, the planet of confusion and drunkenness. Prisoners, shut-in saints, artists, and mystics call this home. Imagination, linking and connecting to the unknown are all facets of the 12th house. It is where the material and non-physical worlds connect. It is both the beginning and the end. So,
well, I guess if we want to look at it in a very, like, the beginning, we're planning for a wedding. The ending, Mad-Eye Moody died. So that's kind of very black and white looking at that.
Yeah, well, I know that is a good theme to go off of, because it's the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. So we're like, you know, in our heteronormative society, the wedding of a man and wife is considered one of the most important milestones in any person's in their life.
Right. Yeah. That's kind
so
of
that's
like
supposed to be one of the
yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be one of the highest things, but then we're also dealing with the death of Mad-Eye Moody, which is like the lowest of the lows. Like, honestly, what is the name of the movie? It's the one where Orlando Bloom, he plays it with an American accent. He plays this American who goes to it's a typical kind of rom-com-y thing where he's so obsessed with work, and then finally he learns to slow down by meeting a manic pixie girl flight attendant who shows him that there's more to life. And I forget its name, but there's a point where
Elizabethtown.
Kristen
Dunst. Yes.
Yeah, Kristen Dunst. Yeah, yeah. The girl who was Interview with the Vampire was the girl vampire.
Yeah.
And also she was Mary Jane in Mary Jane Spider-Man?
Oh yeah. Yeah, she was the Tobey Maguire one. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So so in that one, he goes and, like, in his hotel room, there's this guy, like, there for his bachelorette party. He says, "Oh, I'm here for my dad's funeral." And the guy's like, life and death, right next door to each other.
Exactly.
There's like a hair in between.
That's funny. Yeah. Hey, man, I haven't thought about that movie in a long time. I mean, like that movie.
Me neither. It was because I think it was the first one ever. I'm like, why the fuck does he sound like that? Is he trying to be American?
Yeah. Now it's all coming back to me.
And also because they're supposed to say he's from Oregon, and everyone keeps just dismissing him as being from California. And I was just like, yep, I can relate.
Yeah. It's in part of it's in Kentucky, and I've been to a house like that in Kentucky. So that made me, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, just also because it's the house ruled by Pisces, it immediately makes me think of Ron, who is a Pisces, who is, for all the uncertainty, Ron is one of the most well-grounded emotionally in these few chapters. Ron has taken a big departure of what we're typically used to.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's very different. Like, it's almost like he had some time to mature over the summer. So And it finally,
yeah, like if I, it feels like just the light switched off and he's like, oh, shit just got real.
Yeah.
And I need to act accordingly.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I, with, if we're going to go with the light and the dark, the birth and the death, it's funny to have like a wedding coming up in this, these books. I never really thought it would kind of happen, but it is a marker. And I just think things are going to go, something's going to go wrong. So, and also too, the, you know, Dumbledore's death is still kind of looming large over everything. Still.
Indeed. They go super Irish with the wedding, with the music in the movie.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because you know, again, it's not directly said if the Weasleys are like Scottish or Irish. I always presume them to be Irish.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming that because the Irish are typically Catholic and having so many children, because Catholicism looks down on contraception.
Yeah. 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 Hmm. Oh, cool. All right. 12th house.
12th house. Good stuff. And then now we move at last to the last exercise, which is fan fiction time.
Well, you know how I like to kill people. So I really did think that somebody else was going to die. I didn't think it was Mad-Eye Moody, but what if, and I don't know if Fred or George die, but I know one of them does. So what if George died right away? It wasn't just a head wound. It was like he was a goner.
If that would have happened, then they would have had to physically restrain Harry from just leaving.
I was also like, well, then the wedding probably wouldn't happen. I don't know. But that the implication, I know this death is a big deal. But, and everybody talks about this as like so sad. It's driving me nuts that I don't know what it is. So I'm trying to move it forward in the book. So I
and get it over with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just didn't think, because I kind of was in the, like, what if someone else different had died? You know, what if Moody had survived and someone else died? Because I won't go into too much detail, but I did once read a fan fiction, which was a pretty good one, where Dumbledore does not die on the tower, but they made it so that Dumbledore was in this battle and that he died in this sky battle, and that they made it so that Hermione was not with Kingsley, but that Hermione was with Dumbledore, and Dumbledore like dies behind her.
Who kills him?
Again,
was it Voldemort?
Like I forget exactly who like threw the curse, but yeah, so that was an interesting concept of putting delaying Dumbledore's death by a few weeks for very pivotal plot point reasons.
Yeah, huh. I wonder how that would change things down the road, but yeah.
So when we finish the series, I'll give you that, because again, that's one of my favorite fanfics that I want to like do in my bookbinding project.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I'll be curious. What was yours? Mine was just kind of like, I mean, to be quite honest, I thought it was trying to think about it at the very last minute, and that's all.
No, I only thought of one like halfway through recording this episode, because again, it's been one of those days.
Yeah, amen to that. Yeah.
Well, and again, I've been constantly in fanfic mode. I've read like 5 novel length fanfics like in the last 2 weeks. Like I'm just powering through it. So I even joined a fanfic, a Harry Potter fanfic Facebook group, so I can revel with other fanfic readers.
Oh, good. That's good.
So I tend to think of who, I'm just trying to think structure of the story. Like, who else could die? Again, what if Bill died and there is no wedding? If we want to go if we're going to go like Hunger Games, where they immediately kill off, was it Finn or Flynn, whatever his name is, from the 4th district?
I was thinking of
like right after he got married.
Oh yeah. Gosh, it's been a minute since I've read those. Wow. that's funny that you said, Bill, cause I was going to say, what if like Fleur died? Sad.
Yeah. Also, yeah. So there would be no wedding, and then,
right.
And then they wouldn't. I guess the question is, if either Fleur or Bill died and there was no wedding, then what could Molly, would Molly be even in a position to be harping on Harry, Ron, and Hermione and strategizing to keep them apart? Would she just completely fall apart? Would she, I guess, would the somberness of either Bill or Fleur dying, would that have helped, you know, Harry and the Golden Trio to like be able to strategize and leave, or would have made things 10 times worse?
Oh, if it was Bill, then I feel like for sure, like, she would have been like, they probably wouldn't have been able to leave like one room in the house without supervision. Cause I feel like her losing a child is not going to be something she recovers from very easily. Mm-hmm. Fleur, I could see her like using that, like the funeral planning, as a distraction to keep them together.
We go from wedding planning to funeral planning, and that,
I think so. Like, why not? You know, especially if it's, yeah, I mean, she could do it and make it like, oh, we've really got to help them, you know, whatever. And you've really got to do this and stuff. So,
yeah, I'm just trying to think anything else. Again, I always, because I very much disagree with Mrs. Weasley's position, I would like, what if she was just a little bit more accepting like Arthur in regards to the inevitability that she can't save Harry, and not being such a hindrance to their preparations. Like, I want that Molly Weasley so badly.
Yeah. Well, there's another story to write. That's if she was like chill, not like psycho, and not that she's psycho. Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, and then I feel bad that even if that's the perception, why is that? Because Arthur doesn't want to be the bad cop, and so so like with a lot of women, they're forced in this position of, you know, having to get shit done because the men aren't doing it, and then being made the bad guy for getting shit done, and therefore not being the fun one.
Tale as old as time in home life and work. I think both of those things happen.
Indeed. All right, then. But yeah, that's all I've got.
I'm sure it's about to all fall apart in the next couple chapters. So.
Yeah, because our next chapters, which we will go over next week, is chapter 8, The Wedding, and chapter 9, A Place to Hide.
Yeah, naturally. It sounds like what's going to happen.
Do you feel vindicated?
I mean, yeah, I feel like we knew it was coming, so yeah. Cool.
Alrighty then. So yeah, catch you guys later for chapters 7 and 8. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMare Studios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.